This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The way our political districts are drawn has begun to wreak havoc on the political system that has served the United States so well down through its history. Districts across the country have been drawn to serve one party over the other, to protect a politician from one party from losing that seat to the other party. The result, in many cases, is the end of the need for Democrats to compete against Republicans and vice versa. Now the competition has shifted to intra-party rivalries, where candidates having to prove their worthiness to the extreme fringes of each party. And this is why we have very little middle ground in politics today and no room for compromise. It's why we can't seem to get anything done. At least in North Carolina, there is a bipartisan move afoot to change how districts are drawn. And we're going to talk about that this hour. Harry Taylor is author of You Can't Get There From Here. It's a book about gerrymandering. A Democrat, he also ran for Congress in 2008 against Sue Myrick in District 9, a traditionally Republican district. Mr. Taylor lost.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Welcome to the program. You are a Democrat or you're an independent?
I'm still Democrat.
Okay. Mitch Kokai is communications director for the John Locke Foundation, an independent nonprofit think tank whose stated mission is to transform government through competition, innovation, personal freedom, and personal responsibility. He joins us from the studios at Duke University. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome. And sitting right next to him at Duke is Jane Pinsky, the executive director of the North Carolina Coalition for Lobbying and Government Reform, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization which they say is dedicated to promoting good government policies that level the playing field for the citizens of North Carolina. Thank you for joining us, too.
Thank you for having me.
All three of these folks will be in Charlotte tonight, part of a fair redistricting discussion sponsored by Common Cause North Carolina at Caldwell Presbyterian on East 5th. I don't know whether it's open to the public, but
yes,
I'm assuming.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so it is. Well, now, did I get the synopsis of the problem right with regard to the way districts are drawn? Is one of the primary reasons we have for rising polarization of our politics and our inability to compromise on anything largely due to how these districts are drawn across the country? Jane?
Absolutely. We now have technology that lets us draw districts down to the houses on a block so that you can create districts that are lean one way or the other politically, and even lean one way or the other within a political party.
Now, it was more difficult, obviously, to do this before computers, but we've been doing this for a long time. You point out in your book, Harry, gerrymandering. Where does the term come from?
Back in 1812. Yeah, 1812 is when it started. Governor in Massachusetts.
Governor Jerry.
Governor Jerry crafted a Senate district for what was then the Democratic Republican Party that put all the power into that party into their hands. And so when people looked at the map that they'd drawn, it looked like a salamander, and they called it gerrymander after Governor Jerry.
And the term stuck. So we started in 1812. I was going to ask how we got to where we are today and how what we're doing is different from what we did 40 or 50 years ago. You know, in the days of Tip O'Neill and Everett Dirksen and Ronald Reagan and LBJ, we had people with diametrically opposed points of view who got things done. That doesn't happen anymore. So what happened, Mitch?
Well, I think the biggest change we've seen in North Carolina is that this past time around, Republicans were the ones who drew the maps. It's the first time in anyone's living memory that Republicans had a chance to draw the maps, which raised the level of attention among some people who hadn't spent much time thinking about this before. For decades and decades, the new election maps that had to be drawn, and they have to be drawn after every census, were drawn by Democrats, and they were drawn to favor Democrats. This time around, Republicans had the chance, and rather than change the process, which some of them had talked very adamantly about doing,
when they were in the minority,
right. Rather than changing the process so that you took as much of the politics out of the map drawing process as possible, some of them decided that hey, we've got the power. This sounds pretty good. Let's find a way to keep ourselves in power. Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing a shift in who is supporting redistricting reform now.
But in North Carolina and in other states around the country, we had Democratic majorities for a very long time. And as you point out, the Democrats are just as guilty of gerrymandering as the Republicans are. But we used to be able to get things done. And even in some Republican gerrymandered districts, we were able to get things done. Why can't we get things done anymore? Why can't we reach a compromise on almost anything?
Well, if this one's to me, I would say that one reason is that you do have some districts that are almost certainly going to go to one party or the other.
Sure.
And if that's true, then the decision for the candidate or the elected person in office is not necessarily what do I have to do that's not only going to get enough support from my own political partisan supporters, but also would be something that's not going to get me driven out of office by middle-of-the-road independent voters, but what do I have to pass, what do I have to support that's going to ensure I'm not going to get a primary opponent? Because no one's ever going to beat me from the other party. It's only, if I'm going to lose an election, it's only going to be someone from within my own party who's mad because I didn't toe the party line. And so that's the case where you have people, either Republicans or Democrats. In our state, it's going to more likely be Republicans now because they have the majorities. But who say, what do I have to vote for? What do I have to approve that's going to ensure I don't get a primary opponent because people are mad that I didn't toe the party line in every instance?
But that still hasn't answered my question. What's different about the process that we have gotten to this point where candidates are afraid of being primaried if they don't adhere to the whims of the extremes of their party, be they Republican or Democrat?
I think, Mike, that and this doesn't talk about gerrymandering or talk about the fair redistricting right now, but just the general tenor in the country is that people are polarized, and they're polarized by media, and they're polarized by political parties, and they're polarized by their friends, and people are expecting that they can get everything that they want, and you do that by crushing the other political party. And that's become a prevalent attitude throughout the country.
So, Jane, is this the coming together of these two forces, gerrymandering and high polarization, or has one led to the other?
Oh, I do think they interact. But we can do gerrymandering in a very specific way now so that we can create a district. Let me backtrack and say that of the 13 congressional districts in our state, only one was truly competitive in the last election. And of the 159 seats in our legislature, only 11 were truly competitive. So if you're in a district that's overwhelmingly Democratic in North Carolina, your fear is that you're going to be, as Mitch said, primaried from someone who is probably to the left of you. So because that's where the bulk of your voters are. And so you're going to move to the left. If you're a Republican in North Carolina, with the rise of the strong Tea Party emphasis in the state, you're going to be afraid of being primaried from the right. Mm-hmm. So you're going to hew further to the right. In the past, we haven't been able to cut districts this specifically, so that you had a district that was 51% Republican, but the other 49% was Democratic, and so you had to find someplace closer to the middle. And polls show that Americans, 51% of Americans really are in the middle, whether they're Republicans, independents, or Democrats, that they sit toward the middle. But in the primary elections, the fear is somebody from the wings of your party.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about this yesterday, that it's gotten to the point where the vast number of voters are in the middle. They're neither far right nor far left. And nobody is playing to them. Nobody is speaking to them because they're all playing to the far right and the far left. You say, Jane, that there are 30 members of the U.S. House of Representatives who are in districts that are so uncompetitive that they are not really accountable to anybody because of this partisan gerrymandering. Not accountable to anyone?
If you're in a district where as long as you hew to the party line whatever it is, whether it's centrist Republican, centrist Democrat, extreme left Democrat, or extreme right Republican, and you know you're going to be reelected, then you don't have to worry about pleasing the people in your district. And there are 30 members of the U.S. House whose districts are so cut that as long as they hew to the far right, some of them even to the right of Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor, that they're going to be reelected. So they don't have to worry about what the rest of their district thinks. And that's really frightening. I know a legislator who says, I'm elected by the people of my district, but I'm elected to serve the people of my state. And I think the people of my state is getting lost.
Wow.
And not just in North Carolina.
All right. We're continuing our discussion this morning on fair districting, which is a playoff of what we talked about yesterday on this program, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Those 30 members of the U.S. House that Jane talked about is just the tip of the iceberg. And in your book, Harry, you write about the problem on a little larger scale. And I'd like you to read a couple of paragraphs that I've outlined in that book for us.
Okay, I'm talking about at the end of the book, and what I say in here is approximately 370 of 434 districts. That's 87.4%. In other words, one party, either Republican or Democrat, holds what amounts to a franchise, a lock on who is elected in those districts, a franchise on who goes to Washington to write laws, to spend money, to vote on issues like war, corporate power, clean air, government spending, the safety of the prescription drug your 10-year-old daughter needs, and income tax. That means citizens who live within those districts but do not belong to the district's dominant party are powerless to change their representation. Put simply, their votes don't count. In democracy, in the democracy we believe we have, the one we talk about so fondly and try to export around the world, it's not supposed to work that way. The truth is, those voters' ability to affect change has been explicitly and surgically stripped away. Who is affected? Assume that each congressional district averages 700,000 people. Not every one of those people is eligible to vote because of age, citizenship, or choice, but all are, in theory, entitled to representation in the U.S. House. Multiply these by the 700,000 people in the 370 districts that are non-competitive. The result is 259 million people out of 308 million people live within districts engineered to produce a predetermined winner in every election. As a citizen living in an alleged democracy, I find it sickening. And I've lived in North Carolina in District 9 for 24 years, 27 years now, yet my vote determined my representation in the U.S. House of Representatives, the People's House, has never counted, not one single time.
So 259 million people have been disenfranchised. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they're affected because they're in districts that aren't competitive. So just little more than 12% of the population in this country live in districts whose vote actually counts. And if I'm a Democrat in a district that is Republican district, there's no reason for me to even vote. I'm not gonna tip that balance.
And is that the case in North Carolina? Pretty much the same thing on a smaller scale.
Worse.
How so?
In North Carolina, Jane has. I think these figures came from Jane, but or this comes from Michael Bitzer up at Catawba College.
20 seconds.
Okay, 1,100. Go ahead. 11 of 120 House districts are competitive. 3 of 50 Senate districts are competitive.
Wow. All right, we're going to come back and talk more about the problem and get to some solutions, perhaps, because I know that the North Carolina Coalition for Lobbying and Government Reform, the John Locke Foundation, and you, Harry, are working on this. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about fair redistricting and the possibility that might be able to take place somewhere in this country, including North Carolina, with Harry Taylor, an author and a former candidate in the 9th Congressional District, Mitch Kokai, Communications Director of the John Locke Foundation, and Jane Pinsky, Executive Director of the North Carolina Coalition for Lobbying and Government Reform. With congressional approval ratings being so low, they're historically low, and every time we hear new figures, they're again a new historical low, and with disfavor of Republicans at the moment, at least, congressional Republicans being so historically high, In fact, I read a story yesterday in a newspaper that the headline was "Throw the Bums Out." Given redistricting, you can't throw the bums out, can you?
Not till 2016.
But I mean, even with 2016's election, given redistricting, if you're really, really unhappy with gridlock, if you're really, really unhappy with what's going on, with holding the government hostage essentially to one particular, unless one particular thing is done, you cannot throw these people out because of gerrymandering.
Well, it's certainly difficult. Now, it's not impossible. The previous districts that North Carolina had were drawn to favor Democrats.
Correct.
And during a big wave Republican election in 2010, Republicans were able to win massive majorities in both the North Carolina House and the North Carolina Senate, which was what gave them the power to draw the maps the last time around. So it is possible, but it's very difficult. And one of the things that we haven't touched on yet is beyond the notion of the seeing bad results from polarization, the idea of having politicians draw their own lines and choose who gets to vote for them rather than it being the other way around is the key principle that's wrong with the way election maps are drawn now.
Let's talk about this because you brought this up, Mitch, that because of the census, it's the law that these districts, at least the congressional districts, must be redrawn to reflect the results of the census every 10 years. In North Carolina, who does the redrawing?
When it comes to the congressional maps and the maps for the North Carolina House and Senate, it's the members of the North Carolina House and Senate. What they usually have done is to assign a committee of House members. It's basically a small subset of members of the House in the majority party with the backing, of course, of the Speaker. And in the Senate, it's a small subset of the majority party members of the Senate with the backing of the President pro tem, who put together a plan for each of their own chambers. Mm-hmm. And then together, they put together a House-Senate legislative committee that draws a map for the members of Congress. Now, a couple of instances where this has created problems in the past. Republicans fumed after the last redistricting when Senator Brad Miller of Wake County, who was the chairman of the Senate's redistricting committee, helped draw a congressional map that, favored him in running for the Congress, and he ended up being a member of Congress for 10 years. Mm-hmm. This past time around, when Republicans drew the maps, State Senator David Rouser wanted to run for Congress, and so a congressional district that had largely been based around the Wilmington area and southeastern North Carolina was redrawn so that it spiked up into the Fayetteville area, which was, surprise, surprise, near where Senator Rouser lived. It went up all the way into Johnston County in his home county. So basically the idea that we need to fight by having this redistricting reform that's being pushed is that politicians shouldn't be in the business of drawing election maps so that they can decide who gets to vote for them. It should be that the voters decide who's going to be serving in office, not that the politicians get to pick who will be voting for or mm-hmm. against them.
But now, Mitch, you are with you're the communications director for the John Locke Foundation. The John Locke Foundation is a conservative organization. It leans to the conservative side of things. The fact that Republicans redistricted North Carolina to favor Republicans should make you very happy, but you're not happy. You're trying to change things. Why?
If we were a Republican group, we probably would be very happy. We'd be saying, right on, do what the Democrats did to you and do it even better. But we're not. We're a limited government organization. We support Republicans when they like the ideas of limited constitutional government. We support Democrats when they support those ideas. What we're about is making sure that the government is limited to doing what it's supposed to do, what it is bound by the Constitution, by the law, by the rules of the game to do. And so when you set up a system that allows the politicians to write their own rules to keep themselves in power, it doesn't matter whether it's Democrats or Republicans. It's a bad deal. It certainly hurts the integrity of the system. One of the big debates that we had in North Carolina during this past year was over an election law that featured voter identification but had some other provisions. The Republicans who supported this measure talked about improving the integrity of the election system. Democrats disagreed and said that the changes that they wanted to make did not have any impact on voter integrity. But that was the debate, and that's what the debate should have been, the integrity of the electoral system. The way that we redistrict and draw the new election maps now has nothing to do with the integrity of the electoral system. All it's about now is preserving the party in power. That's the way it's been for decades and decades. Republicans, some of them, promised to change the system when they were elected into power, and they didn't. They just went along with what the Democrats did, and now with new technology are able to do it even better.
So, Jane, your organization, the North Carolina Coalition for Lobbying and Government Reform, is pushing for change. You've been holding town hall meetings across the state. You're holding one here tonight to, quote, educate the public about the redistricting process. What do we need to know that we don't know?
Well, I think the fact that every office in North Carolina is redistricted, from our legislative districts to our congressional districts, city council, school board, county commissioner, and that it needs to be a process without partisanship. Many people aren't aware of the fact that it does happen every 10 years, and that there are places where they have found better answers to the problem than we have. Mm. And most of all, that what it does is undermine citizen confidence in government. It's one of the reasons fewer people vote. Why go out to vote if you know that whether you vote or not, the candidate's going to win? And that probably
Or the candidate has no competition.
Right. And there were uncontested races in the North Carolina House and Senate this year where from day one, there was one candidate running in the primary in one party, and there was no competition.
You know, we used to laugh at the communist regimes who held these so-called elections in which there was one candidate, and the candidate would win with 98% of the vote, and we would find that laughable. And yet, here we are doing it right here, right now, in this country, in this state, and nobody's that upset about it. I mean, you are, but people are not up in arms. It looks like a banana republic in some cases.
And Mike, it's not just the case of the elections in which there is no contest. There are a number of contests because of the way some of the districts are drawn in which it's not really a contest. There is the majority party that is going to win the election, and the other party puts up a sacrificial lamb because they don't want the other candidate to get a free ride.
Right.
But it's certainly not someone who's given a lot of backing by the other members of the party. And so you have a large number of elections beyond just those uncontested races where there's no real contest.
That leads me back to you, Harry Taylor. You ran for Congress against Sue Myrick. She was a multiple-time incumbent when you ran against her in 2008 in North Carolina's 9th District. Did you lose that election because she was the incumbent, and it's very difficult to beat an incumbent in any race? Did you lose because of the way the district there was drawn, which makes it nearly impossible for a Democrat to win in that district? Did you lose because you were one of these sacrificial lambs that the Democrats put up but didn't really truly support because they knew that the Republican couldn't be beaten in that district? Or did you lose because people just didn't like you and didn't like your policies and liked Sue Myrick?
Mike, I always contended from day one that if I could have met every voter in the district, 640,000, whatever it was, voters in the district, face-to-face, that I would have won the election hands down. But that district now has been in Republican hands for now 60 years.
It was, and why would you have won if you could have shaken everybody's hand and met everybody?
Because I'm a different individual than she was.
Yeah, but she's very likable. When you get to know Sue Myrick, she's very likable.
No, I think she's difficult, and I
okay.
I think this isn't about Sue. She's gone. She's retired. Her time is over. But
okay.
It's about my response. You know what happens, Mike, is when you run in a district like that, and I believed in the trying times of leading up the 2008 election, that that I had a chance. And as I went out to talk to people over the 13 months that I was running for office, I found again and again and again that people didn't believe I had a chance based on history. They wouldn't make contributions. They wouldn't endorse me. They wouldn't hold events for me. They wouldn't give me a chance to speak. So it was very difficult to...
Well, you said you discovered this over time. Surely you knew that this was the gerrymandered district.
Absolutely. Yes,
okay,
I knew that.
Okay, so you knew that going into this race. Why did you pursue it?
Because I thought in that time that there was a chance that I could win. that I thought that there's maybe I could upset the thing, just like other people. Mm-hmm. You know, Jennifer Roberts did this time. Jennifer's running in that district, although it's reconfigured. Jennifer believed that if she did everything right and a couple things fell her way, that she could win and upset that balance that had been in effect in force for 60 years.
Well, now, you know, it doesn't just happen on the Republican side. Let's be fair about this, because in the 12th congressional district, Mel Watt's seat has been referred to as the poster child for gerrymandering. If you look at how it's drawn, it snakes from Charlotte to Winston-Salem. It makes no sense at all. How did that district survive the latest redistricting effort on the part of Republicans?
I think one of the main reasons it did was because Republicans in drawing districts, both legislative districts and congressional districts, had a different mindset than Democrats in terms of how the Democratic districts would look. If you already had a 12th district that was overwhelmingly Democratic, there was no good reason for Republicans to change that, because that means that the rest of the districts are going to skew a little bit more Republican. And in fact, what they did with the 13 districts that North Carolina has in the U.S. House of Representatives, they drew three districts that are very, very Democrat. It would be almost impossible for a Republican to win in the 1st district, in the 4th district, or in the 12th district. The incumbent would have to do something really crazy and terrible. The rest of the 10 districts, because so many Democrats are in those three districts, are much more likely to lean Republican. Now, if there's a wave election for Democrats, there are a number of these Republican incumbents, especially those who are in their first or second term, who could be vulnerable to a Democratic wave. But they are much more likely to win in those districts because so many Democrats are in the first, the 12th, and the 4th.
If you look at the first congressional district, you'll notice that G.K. Butterfield won by 60 percentage points. The result was 80% for him and 20 for his opponent. When that district was drawn, they knew that that was a district that they could draw and keep other districts safe. And it's not something that the Democrats didn't do before. That's why Sue Myrick's district was drawn. Mm-hmm. You draw districts to, as much as possible, compact the people that aren't going to vote for you in one place and free up your voters to vote elsewhere.
Hmm. As I listen to this, I realize there are a whole bunch of people out there whose eyes glaze over when the conversations get really political. Ah, this is all politics. I just want to be able to buy bread at a certain price. I want the price of gasoline to be low. I want to be free, blah, blah, blah. So many people don't get involved in this because they don't feel that it affects their daily lives. But Jane, you say that the way congressional districts are drawn does affect our daily lives. How?
It's not just congressional districts. It's, as I said, city council districts, school board districts. In Wake County, we've seen rapid sort of back and forth on our school board because of the way districts were drawn. In the legislature, we've seen policies turned around because of the way districts are drawn. So it affects absolutely everything in everybody's daily life, from where the stop sign is on your corner, to what's happening to your kids at school, to what's happening with a local hospital, to what the tax is on gasoline, to whether or not our government's going to open up sometime this week and not default on our debt. And all of those affect the interest rates we pay. They affect the availability of mortgages. They affect our jobs. I know that even my own husband's eyes sort of glaze over when I say redistricting, and he goes, yeah, one man, one vote, right, and drifts off. But, you know, what he does for a living is impacted by what OSHA does, by what happens in our state universities. So what happens in everybody's lives is impacted by redistricting.
We're talking about two words that have not gone together very often in this country, fair redistricting, this morning on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. There's an article in the Huffington Post written by our Attorney General, Roy Cooper, who is bemoaning what has taken place after 50 years of what he calls progressive democratic leadership that put North Carolina at the forefront of Southern reform and progressiveness, to what's been happening since Republicans took over the state house and the legislature. And obviously he's putting he's kind of putting his feelers out to run for governor. So you're seeing the Democratic point of view. So if you agree with him that the state has taken a step backwards, then you realize that what's happened because of redistricting it does affect your daily life. If you agree with the Republicans, then you realize that what redistricting has done affects your daily life. Both sides can be affected. Why don't we realize this until it's too late?
I think mainly because of the situation that you and Jane described, that people hear the words redistricting or they hear about politics and they think, oh, you know, it doesn't really affect me. I just go and vote every couple of years or once every 4 years. And then otherwise, government, do what you're going to do and leave me alone. Well, you know, if you want to have a government that reflects what you and what your neighbors and what people in your communities think, you need to not only participate in the process by voting, but you need to have a system in place that ensures that your votes are going to count as much as everyone else's.
How do you draw a district? How do you deliberately sit down and draw a district to favor one party over another? How do you do it?
Well, there are advanced computer programs that are able to pinpoint by even down to census tract and probably which house you live in, what you have voted, where you have voted in the past, what your registration is. We have seen the technology advance to the stage where, you know, if your buddy lives a couple blocks away from where your district ends, you could redraw the map slightly so that you could get him in there. I don't know that it gets to that level very often, but certainly the technology is very advanced.
If you look at some of these districts, they are oddly drawn. They look funny. You think, well, what is this area over here have in common with this area? It's so far away, and you obviously see this thin line snaking through to get from one area to the other. Does anybody police this? Does anybody look at these things and say, well, that's obviously gerrymandered?
Well, there is a provision within the constitutional law that the districts have to be somewhat compact, right, but they're given a lot of leeway in dealing with that.
Mitch Kokai, let me stop you there because we have to take a break. Mitch Kokai is Communications Director of the John Locke Foundation. We're coming right back with him, Jane Pinsky, and Harry Taylor right after this break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Harry Taylor, author of You Can't Get There From Here, about his run for the Congress in the 9th Congressional District several years ago. He's with us in an effort to help us explain this oxymoron that doesn't have to be one, fair redistricting. Mitch Kokai is with us from Duke University, Communications Director of the John Locke Foundation, and Jane Pinsky, also at Duke, Executive Director of the North Carolina Coalition for Lobbying and Government Reform. So, given technology today, you can really be highly detailed in how you draw these districts to favor your party over the other party. There's a bill in the North Carolina House, House Bill 606, which has been filed, but it's received – I didn't know anything about this bill. It's received very little attention, but it would establish a nonpartisan redistricting process. The bill has 61 sponsors and co-sponsors. It was introduced in April of this year. Tom Tillis, the Speaker of the House, has called this good legislation, with 61 out of 120 House members supporting the bill, and with Tom Tillis's support. Why has this gotten zero traction?
We did pass a similar bill in 2011, and it didn't get traction this time because of the partisan politics that played out. It became a bargaining chip from both sides on several other issues. So, unfortunately, it didn't get the attention it deserves. Because in addition to the 61 co-sponsors, Speaker Tillis, there are probably another 8 to 10 people who support the legislation in Mecklenburg County alone. Representative Cotham, Representative Jeter are both big supporters. Mm-hmm. Representative William Brawley supported us the last time around and just didn't move fast enough to get their names on the bill.
My best guess is the reason that it didn't get voted on this time was because it did pass through the General Assembly with basically about the same lineup of people in 2011, and the Senate just sat on the idea and didn't do anything with it. And I think the House people who were really pushing it this time around said, okay, you know, until we get some sense that the Senate's going to do something with this, why take the time this time around? They know we want to do it. We've got 61 votes for it. We can do it. let's get a sense of whether the Senate would go along with us before we take the time and effort.
This is identical to a bill that you mentioned, Jane, passed by the House in 2011, which mimics the fair redistricting mechanism practiced in Iowa. Describe that system.
It's a pretty simple system. The census data, which is produced every 10 years, goes to three members of the professional staff at the legislature. In Iowa, they use a lawyer, a demographer, a geographer. They draw the districts based on districts that are compact, contiguous, respect state and federal law, which in North Carolina would include the Voting Rights Act and the whole county provision, and respect what is an emerging area in redistricting called communities of interest, so that you understand that a rural area does not always have the same interests as a urban area. And then they look at natural boundaries. They draw the districts without looking at where the incumbents live. And as Mitch and I were talking during the break, that's a big factor. We draw districts making sure incumbents are where they want to be. Mm. They don't look at political registration. They do not look at the results of past elections. So they're drawing those maps blind and clear. And in fact, in Iowa, of the 150 people in the General Assembly, in the House and Senate there, 37 of them were what we call double bunked. That is, ended up in a district running against somebody else, but all of them voted for the bill because they trust the system.
But now
and
this
then
is.
The legislature votes on the bill and uh-huh. there's citizen input.
But there would be people listening to this conversation who would say, well, that's Iowa. That's not North Carolina. We're different here, are we?
I don't know that we're that different, Harry.
Now, the promise of democracy is for participation by its citizens, and we participate by voting. We participate by being able to talk to the people who actually represent us.
When you
skew the process so that our vote doesn't count, then you're not giving people the opportunity to participate.
Jane Munch just mentioned that election laws are followed with the Iowa redistricting process, and surely there are laws governing all this. I'm just curious as to why there isn't, particularly for federal elections for the House of Representatives in Washington, why there is not one rule that governs how congressional districts are drawn in every state in the union. Why?
Because
there is one rule. The legislatures get to do it.
Why? Because that says everybody does it differently or has the potential for doing it differently.
It's states' rights.
The legislatures get to draw them, but there is a long series of case law from the federal courts, including many, many, many cases from North Carolina that have helped put some restraints on legislatures. But the reason we have the one man, one vote principle now is because of legislatures in years past, not just North Carolina, but in states across the country that had all kinds of crazy districts where you'd have a handful of people in one district getting to vote for a member of Congress, where huge numbers of people would be living in another district. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't have the one man, one vote principle. That came about through the courts. The idea of just what constitutes a majority-minority district is something that has been going through the courts. North Carolina has played a key role in that issue. In fact, that legislation and court cases that have had to deal with North Carolina redistricting have gone through the federal courts as late as 2009. From our last redistricting in 2002, it went all the way through the courts for 7 or 8 years before some of these standards were finally set by federal judges, including the U.S. Supreme Court.
So is this Iowa process what the three of you are advocating for North Carolina?
We think it's the best process that we've found. There are other states that have what are called independent redistricting commissions, but the commissions are made up, with the exception of California, of political appointees, and political appointees take care of partisan interests. We think Iowa presents the cleanest process. It has a strict timetable. They do it between February and May. We did ours between February and August, September. And as Mitch said, in some cases, it's taken us 8 or 9 years to do redistricting.
So again,
now our
go ahead.
I was going to say, in our group, the Locke Foundation is not locked into any particular plan, but what we do think is important and is spelled out to some extent in this bill is that this process needs to be determined by rules and not as much by people, whether it's an independent commission, whether it's legislative staff. There need to be rules that hamstring these folks from using politics and instead say, no, it has to be compact. You don't look at incumbents. You don't look at political registration. Make sure that the rules bind whoever's drawing the maps as much as possible, and good rules.
So in Iowa, these are nonpartisan professional map drawers, correct? How are they how are they appointed? How do they get those jobs?
They are professional staff working for the state. Many people don't know it, but most states have a state geographer, including North Carolina. They have a state demographer, including North Carolina. And the third person is usually a lawyer. Quite logically, they are state employees, not politically appointed state employees who can do the job. We have a great professional staff at the legislature, as I think even the Republican Party, which had great doubts about the nonpartisanship of that staff, has discovered over the last 3 to 4 years. For the most part, our professional staff is professionals, and whatever they may think personally, they do the job they're supposed to do.
And if you're worried about the partisanship of the people in these particular jobs, that's why you want a system that has rules that bind them, that say, okay, no matter your political preference, these are the rules that are going to guide you. You're not going to follow the old process of, hey, let's help our buddy out in this part of the state, or let's hurt the person we don't like in that part of the state. The rules are what should govern the process.
But what would provoke or allow a state legislator who has to make the rule change to allow this kind of a commission to come into existence, what would provoke them to give up the power that they have now to do this themselves, to favor themselves?
Because nobody's guaranteed to be in power forever. The Democrats certainly thought after 130, 140 years that they were going to get to run the show forever, and that isn't what happened. And we need to look at the fact that North Carolina is changing at a rapid rate. It is not the state that I've lived in for the last 30 years. We have huge demographic changes. We have influx of population from elsewhere around the country.
Yes, but
around the world.
But isn't the Tea Party response in North Carolina and elsewhere partially, it's been described at least, as a last gasp, last ditch effort to maintain the status quo in the face of what these demographic changes are bringing to the state?
Right, but elected officials want to get reelected.
Yes, but so why exactly? So why would you want to give up that power?
Go ahead, Mitch. I think it's a tough sell this time around. We do need to push forward with this effort, but it is a tough sell because the Republicans have large advantages. When it's going to be an easier sell for them is when it looks like they're in danger of losing the advantages. So as much as I like participating in the process now and think we should and should put this issue in front of people, we all ought to admit that it's going to be a very tough sell when Republicans have super majorities in the House and Senate. It's going to be an easier sell when they see the Democrats knocking on the door ready to take over again.
Let me get your take on this, Harry.
I think that the time – we've got a speaker who's running for Senate next year, Speaker Tillis, is called this when they filed it the last session when the Democrats were in control, said, we introduced this bill because it's good legislation. He says, we introduced and passed the bill in the last session because it's good legislation. And now in this session, he continues to say it's good legislation. So he can lead a positive vote in the House. And then it's the people's effort to get the Senate to pay attention and pass it. If the people stood up as one in the state and said, we want fair redistricting forever, maybe we can get it done now.
If you were able to get this done, what would these new districts look like, and how would they shape or change the face of the legislature and of the North Carolina delegation to the House of Representatives?
I'll take the easy part of that. The law calls for them to be compact, and it calls for there to be as little difference as possible between length and width of the districts. So they would be increasingly square. We do have the issue of the Voting Rights Act, which will mean that we're not going to get perfectly square blocks. I think that in the long run, what we would have would be a legislature that is more representative of the people of North Carolina, but that may just be my wish, and I'll let Mitch and Harry handle that.
My best guess is over the long term, you would see, because North Carolina is what's often been described as a very purplish state, that our delegation to the U.S. House of Representatives would sort of skew 7-6, 8-5 to one party or the other, depending on which party has had a wave election. Our general assemblies might swing back between Democrats and Republicans from election to election. But because of that, and because you would have a much tighter gap between the party in power and the party in the minority, you would see a lot more across-party bargains to get things done, which has been one of the things that you've talked about at the very top of the hour, the idea of ensuring that people work together to get solutions that both sides, whether they might like them or not like them all that well, they can live with them.
Fair redistricting, the topic of the conversation today on Charlotte Talks. You say there is some urgency in getting these changes made right now, because the closer we get to the 2020 census, the less likely the party in power will be to give up the power of drawing their own districts. But why? If they're willing to do it now, why will they be less willing to do it later?
I think you have people in the General Assembly now who are members of the Republican Party who remember what it was like to be on the outs. You have Democrats who have discovered since 2010 what it's like to be on the outs. We have a moment when we have a critical mass in the General Assembly understanding how the process can be disruptive. I think 3 or 4 years from now, some of the people who've championed this cause, like Speaker Tillis, will have moved on to other things. Will we quit if it doesn't happen this year or next? No. Paul Stamm, who's Speaker Pro Tem of the North Carolina House, has been working on this since 1989. I learned about the Iowa system from the John Locke Foundation in a piece written in 1992. I think we're all in it for the long haul. But in order to turn things around so that in 2021 we can be doing things the right way, we really need to act as quickly as possible.
So if we adopted something along the lines of the Iowa plan, the legislature, correct me if I'm wrong, would still have to okay the maps drawn by this professional commission or professional staff. Is that correct?
Yes.
What would happen if the legislature rejected the maps?
If the legislature rejects the maps, they have 7 days to inform the staff why they rejected the maps. And they can only reject them or amend them on technical grounds, i.e. a district is not compact enough, it doesn't represent the communities of interest. Then the staff would redraw maps based on what the legislature said its objections were. That can go around, that can happen 3 times. In Iowa, it's never gone past the second time. And this, in 2011, it was the first time.
You're traveling the state for with fair redistricting discussions sponsored by Common Cause North Carolina. At 7 p.m. tonight, there's one at Caldwell Presbyterian on East 5th. Are you at all confident that this can get done over time?
I am. I believe it can get done this year.
This year?
I believe it can get done.
Do you share that optimism?
If enough people stand up and speak out throughout the state.
Jane, very quickly, one word, do you share that optimism?
I'm not quite as optimistic as Harry, but I think the thing I've learned is that if the people of North Carolina put their mind to something, they can do it.
I said one word. Executive Director Jane Pinsky of the North Carolina Coalition for Lobbying and Government Reform, Mitch Kokai for John Locke Foundation.